This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Finding the right news podcast can feel like dating. It seems promising until you start listening.
When you hit play on Post Reports, you'll get fascinating conversations and sometimes a little fun, too. I'm Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Azadi. Martine and I are the hosts of Post Reports. The show comes out every weekday from The Washington Post.
You can follow and listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. It'll be a match, I promise.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
The Coin Bureau podcast is a production of iHeartRadio.
The realization was pretty clear that Ethereum was not fast enough, and it hadn't been able to scale up, basically, to cope with all the activity that was taking place on the network. And as I think we've said before, it became a victim of its own success. Welcome, everyone, to the Coin Bureau podcast. My name is Guy, and his name
is Mad Mike Mooch.
We are going to talk about Ethereum today, again.
Part four.
And this is the final part on Ethereum.
Final part that we're talking about it now, I imagine, because I'm sure this story is not over.
Absolutely. This story is just getting started. Mm. So today we're going to kind of bring Ethereum up. Last time we finished up by looking at how Ethereum was at the center of the ICO boom. That was in kind of 2017. That was all through 2017 and into early 2018. And that was involved hundreds of projects launching on the Ethereum network and raising money through these token sales, these initial coin offerings or ICOs, which was this whole new way of raising capital. And boy, did they raise some capital. I mean, we're talking billions here, if you remember. And yeah, it all got a little crazy. And we ended last time by noting that the demand for these ICOs, the demand to participate, the demand to buy tokens was so great that at times the Ethereum network just couldn't cope with it all, with all the people trying to use it, and just kind of crashed or slowed to a crawl. And yeah, so on the timeline, we're roughly at the end of 2017. Okay, so speaking of Ethereum slowing down, before we kind of carry on with the timeline and kind of what happened after that, I want to go back to another event that took place towards the end of November, towards the end of 2017 in November, and that was the launch of the CryptoKitties. The CryptoKitties. I think we may have mentioned these in a previous episode, but for anyone unfamiliar...
I'm unfamiliar.
Okay, so the CryptoKitties were... Well, they still are. They're still a thing. These are digital images of cartoon cats.
Oh, so an NFT.
A range of collectible cartoon cats. They're all different, though. They have this range of discernible attributes. They were called cat-tributes. Yeah, I know. But the whole point was these things, they could be bought and then bred with each other to create new ones. Yeah, so you buy these NFTs and you'd create a new NFT, a new crypto kitty, which would
like
be a
kitty litter.
Yeah, something like that. Something like that. And depending on the two kitties you bred together, the other one would come out with sort of certain characteristics.
So it's kind of like it's Tamagotchi 3.0.
Tamagotchi's a good reference point. I think it's kind of similar, but all on the blockchain, all virtually. These people started buying, collecting, breeding these cats. And I should point out that obviously all these actions, so in order to buy one of these NFTs, in order to breed it, in order to trade it, whatever, you needed ETH, the native currency of Ethereum. So this was obviously a big kind of demand driver for the ETH coin. And yeah, these are one of the earliest examples of NFTs, non-fungible tokens. And each CryptoKitty was represented as an NFT on the Ethereum blockchain. So a quick recap on NFTs for anyone who is still catching up. An NFT basically acts as a digital certificate of ownership that's recorded and traceable, trackable on the blockchain. We discussed these, maybe it was one episode or two episodes ago. Anyhow, and we'll talk about NFTs a lot more in future. Non-fungible, as we said, basically means unique, not interchangeable with other tokens. Kind of fiat money, if you like, is fungible. £1 is equal to another pound. So the CryptoKitties, they weren't the first NFTs, but they were the first collection of them to gain wide attention. They are most people's kind of starting point for the whole NFT.
Bored Ape seems to be like the latest sort of major sort of well-known one.
Yeah, the Bored Ape Yacht Club is...
Oh, is that the thing? Is it a yacht club?
Yeah, at the time of speaking, the Bored Ape Yacht Club is the kind of big name in NFTs, and you can't move for Bored Apes at the moment. And actually, so these CryptoKitties, they were so popular, they really caught the imagination so much, so many people were trading and breeding them, that the Ethereum network became severely congested. And yeah, they're a big early milestone in the development of NFTs and a kind of an early indication of how big this kind of niche was going to become.
Yeah.
And this is a good example of people basically finding a use for Ethereum. I don't know if Vitalik had envisioned this or anything like this when he created it, but it's a perfect example of a group of developers, a group of people looking at Ethereum going, what can we do here? Okay. Why don't we try this? Digital collectibles. Everyone, you know, they're all different, blah, 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 blah. They created a new type of token, what was called an ERC-721 token, if I remember rightly, in order to represent these NFTs on the blockchain. And yeah, they were a big old deal. And they're still going. I mean, they've been, as you point out, they've been kind of overtaken by more...
The latest
more
hip.
Recent. Yeah, the latest fad. But yeah, CryptoKitties were a big
deal. The OG.
The OG NFT, if you want to squeeze some acronyms in. And yeah, we'll talk about NFTs a bit more later on. So late 2017, it also saw Vitalik persuaded to eventually fire Ming Chan, who is the executive director of the Ethereum Foundation. And if you remember, she'd come on board. Yeah, she'd upset a lot of people. Mm. She had a very sort of weird style of management. Her behavior was a little bit erratic. But it wasn't actually until January 2018 that she was sort of finally ushered out the door. And she was replaced by someone called Aya Miyaguchi, who had previously worked at Kraken, which is, well, was then and is now a big cryptocurrency exchange based in the US. So the Ethereum Foundation had this new executive director who I think worked a lot better with Vitalik and was just, you know, a better fit for the role. So this kind of closes a chapter, Ming Chan's departure. And what it meant was that Vitalik was by now the only one of the original Ethereum founders still on board. Ming Chan wasn't an actual founder, but she'd been there for quite a while. All the other founders had either been fired or kind of pushed out the door or just left to kind of go off and do their own thing. So Vitalik was the only one left.
Highlander.
Yeah, there can be only one. And so now let's move into 2018. So as we saw, late 2017 and even early 2018, it was just crazy. As I said, prices were going crazy. Ethereum was touching its all-time high, Bitcoin too, all these ICOs. Everyone was talking about crypto. And obviously, this couldn't last. What goes up must come down. And the warning signs had actually been appearing in 2017. In September, if I remember, China ordered all crypto exchanges to shut down. And this is China is a kind of recurring theme in these years of crypto. It's like China would decide that it was going to crack down on crypto a little bit harder, and the market would tank as a result. So September 2017, China ordered all crypto exchanges to shut down, which obviously made it very difficult for Chinese people to get their hands on crypto. And this was a warning sign. And then on December the 11th, I think it was in the US, the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, issued a cease and desist order against an ICO project. And they accompanied it with a press release saying that the project had been selling unregistered securities. Now, this was bad because, selling securities without a license.
It's a big no-no in America.
Yeah, you can do some pretty good bird for doing that. And, yeah, this was not good news because this is something that still is still kind of hanging over the whole industry. We're seeing this at the moment with the SEC's case against Ripple, where it's saying that it sold XRP as an unregistered security. That case is still not resolved, well into its second year now. And yeah, we still haven't got not even an end in sight, really. Maybe the end of 2022, but who knows? So late December 2017, Bitcoin reached just below 20K, which was an all-time high, and then it crashed big time. And ETH continued pumping into the new year, into 2018, and it hit its all-time high of just over $1,400 on the 13th of January, and then it did the same thing. And this coincided with regulators in the US and elsewhere deciding, right, this has gone far enough. We're going to crack down on crypto. As you can, I guess you can imagine, really, given everything that had been going on, the crazy money being raised by these ICOs. And obviously, sadly, many ICOs turned out to be scams, really. So, people quickly cottoned on that this thing was so hot, this sector was so hot. All you needed to do was come up with a fancy
name idea. Pitch.
Maybe a website, not always a website. Like some of them were just like, you'd think, how on earth would anyone fall for this? But people did, because that's what happens when
there's a gold rush.
Yeah. People are just scrambling over themselves to invest in, whatever comes their way. So obviously, lots of people were losing a lot of money. And that is bound to attract the attention of the regulators. And I mean, people like the SEC, their job is protecting investors. So they kind of had to step in. So ICO fraudsters started getting arrested when they could actually be found. Plenty kind of disappeared without trace and were never seen again. And in January 2018, the BitConnect Ponzi scheme, which had been huge, that imploded in January. Investors lost over $2 billion in it. It was, oh, God. Yeah, I remember it. I remember it pretty well. And it was a terrible time because, the BitConnect thing had promised investors these crazy returns. And there's some just bizarre footage. They had a conference. They had a big BitConnect event. And they had this guy called Carlos Matos on stage who was just crazy. And this footage, if you type in BitConnect into YouTube or something, you'll see this guy. And it's just him, like, just going mental on stage. And he eventually kind of ends it by shouting, BitConnect! It's just, wow. You look at it and you think, anyone new to crypto at that precise moment in time, you could forgive them for just walking away and having nothing to do with it again. You're just like...
Is it worse than that Microsoft dance? When Bill Gates and co were was it Windows 98 or something like that, and they're unveiling it on stage and they're all dancing like the Rolling Stones dads.
Yeah. I think, well, I don't think Windows 95 was necessarily a Ponzi scheme. But, no.
It's, but which is more cringy is still debatable.
Yeah, so there were also concerns over Tether around this time as well. Tether, I think we've touched on it before. This is the company which issues USDT, which is the biggest stablecoin on the market. Mm. Still, it was then, it is now. As well as Tether's sister company, the Bitfinex exchange. There were lots of questions. People were kind of looking into what was going on with them. And the US Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC, was revealed to be investigating both companies in 2018. So again, not a good look for the industry as a whole. And there are actually ongoing concerns. Basically, their concerns around USDT mostly centered on the fact that what assets are actually backing this.
Yeah.
Like you're printing all these stable coins.
Where's the money?
Yeah. Like, you know, where's the money?
How are you operating as a business?
Yeah.
If you know.
Yeah.
It's not backed by gold or actual dollars.
Yeah. Can we please have a look at your books and. Yeah, even today.
Maybe.
Okay.
Maybe late, maybe not.
Oh, I think I've lost the books.
What's a book?
I think I just dropped one of the books into the North Sea.
Yeah.
Anyhow, yes. So even today, there are still concerns about what assets are actually backing Tether, are actually backing USDT. Pretty worrying. Anyway, in short, 2017 was the party and 2018 was the hangover.
That's a great description.
Thanks. It just came to me. So 2018, 2019 is often described now as crypto winter. Winter is coming. Mm. Winter came to crypto. Many projects went to the wall. Those that didn't, their prices took a massive tumble, including 5K Ethereum.
5K for Bitcoin.
Yeah. Isn't well,
that? I remember that.
Yeah, I mean, ETH went down to around $80. When you consider it was $1,400 at one point, I mean, people would have bought in at $1,400.
Mm.
And yeah, that's a heck of a ride down to $80. And as you can imagine, sort of general interest in crypto, it just dropped off a cliff because either people had lost money or they'd heard about people losing money. And so there wasn't really much, you know, there weren't many new people coming into the space. And again, I remember that sort of time. And I mean, I remember thinking, I remember believing that this wasn't the end, but it was kind of hard to believe yourself sometimes during that time. It was difficult because you were sort of convincing yourself that this is going to recover, things are going to get better, and then you check the charts and it's fallen another God knows how many percent. It's like but that said, there was still development going on, but obviously with the sense that the boom was most definitely over. So it was a tricky time. But this time also began to see the emergence of so-called Ethereum killers too. Mm. On that note, should we take a break?
Sure.
You know how much I like a cliffhanger.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect.
Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Classes in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
Welcome back.
Yeah.
Should we talk about some good news that Ethereum had in
2018? No. You want to keep more doom and gloom.
Going with the negativity.
Yeah. Okay, go on, give us good news.
Okay, so there was some good news for Ethereum in 2018. In June, Bill Hinman, who was a director at the SEC, he stated that he believed ETH was not a security because it was, quote, sufficiently decentralized. And he also said the same about Bitcoin, about BTC as well. Now, this is good news because it meant that there weren't necessarily any barriers to, you know, to American investors buying into to ETH or Bitcoin. So that's an important point to note. Other than that, Ethereum had a lot of problems facing it, and not least the emergence of rival smart contracts platforms. So these are often referred to as the Ethereum killers because they all aim to basically replace Ethereum or, you know, take some of its market share by being faster or more decentralized or more secure or ideally all three. And they all kind of promise this to a greater or lesser degree. And there are absolutely tons of so-called Ethereum killers now, and some of them are really big projects, but none has yet come close to toppling Ethereum. And to be honest, I think it's fairly unlikely that any will anytime soon. But we'll talk about these a bit towards the end of the episode as well. But a few examples. I mean, the Tezos, which we mentioned when we talked about ICOs, that's one example of a kind of rival to Ethereum. EOS. Now, EOS held a year-long ICO. It ran from June 17 to June 18, and it raised $4.2 billion. It was absolutely insane. The guy, a tenth
of Twitter.
could have bought themselves a little slice of Twitter for that.
Yeah,
it's extraordinary.
A tea.
Yeah. the guy behind it was this chap Dan Larimer, whose name has come up before. He worked with Charles Hoskinson, who was Ethereum sort of early CEO before he was booted out at the Game of Thrones night that they had. EOS is extraordinary. No one is really able to tell what they did with this $4.2 billion. Not a lot, by the sound of it.
Is it all gone now?
Well, EOS is still going. It's still a top 100 crypto, but not a lot has happened. We'll talk about EOS another time. Another example is Cardano, which was Charles Hoskinson's project. Tron is another one. There are newer ones now. Solana, which is currently the fastest or one of the fastest out there. And Avalanche, which Emin Gunsira, who we talked about before, he started. Phantom's another one. There are absolutely loads. And of course, there's Gavin Wood's Polkadot. That's another competitor. Polkadot is structured, is seen as an Ethereum competitor. It's structured in a slightly different way from some of these other smart contract chains, Ethereum included. It's actually structured more in the way that Ethereum will eventually become.
Okay. And is this with the update to Ethereum?
Yeah, okay. Exactly, which we'll talk about shortly.
Not called 2.0.
Well, it is, but we're not allowed to call it 2.0.
Okay.
Yeah. It gets complicated.
Okay.
No one said this crypto business was easy.
No. Sorry, I keep derailing this. Crack on.
One of Gavin's reasons for moving on from Ethereum, even though he was kind of moved on.
Yeah.
He designed and built Polkadot to fulfill the promises Ethereum could not. I think that's
his statement.
Yeah, something along those lines. Anyhow, now Ethereum. One of the reasons that all these other smart contract platforms, all these Ethereum killers in inverted commas, sprang up was because Ethereum itself was pretty slow. It still can only process around 15 transactions per second, which, as we've seen, is not very many. And remember that Ethereum uses a proof-of-work blockchain, like Bitcoin's. Newer smart contract blockchains made use of another consensus method, which is known as proof-of-stake. Yeah, we have talked about proof-of-stake before. I want to go over it a little bit in a moment or so because it's really relevant to the next stage of Ethereum. Now, most these other smart contract blockchains have now become more commonly known as layer ones, okay, because they're the layer that you build everything else on top. And these have much greater what we call TPS scores, transactions per second. They can process a lot more transactions per second. But few of them really, if any, are as decentralized as Ethereum. And sometimes when you dig into the nuts and bolts of one of these projects, you find out that although they claim to be very decentralized, there's only, sometimes just not even, maybe a couple of hundred validators, which are kind of the same as equivalent to miners. Sometimes there are only maybe 150 or 200 odd validators on the network, and you think, okay, that's more decentralized than one, but that's not
it's not impenetrable. It's you can pressure that, you can change 150 people's mind by
When you consider there are thousands, tens of thousands of both nodes and miners, combined on the Bitcoin network and Ethereum as well. There are lots of people running Ethereum nodes, thousands and thousands, and also plenty of Ethereum miners too, for the time being at least. That is truly decentralization. Having a couple of hundred ain't the same. It ain't decentralized. The realization was pretty clear that Ethereum was not fast enough and it hadn't been able to scale up, basically, to cope with all the activity that was taking place on the network. And as I think we've said before, it became a victim of its own success. So Vitalik, being the massively intelligent chap that he was, had kind of realized this for a while, and by 2018 had already begun working on fixing it. So he wasn't resting on his laurels. And so this is where Ethereum 2.0 comes in.
Don't call it that.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. I'm going to refer to it as Ethereum 2.0 for now, and then I will reveal why we can't call it Ethereum 2.0. This is a command from on high. So, in a nutshell, as we record this and in mid 2022, Ethereum is in the midst of transitioning from its current proof of work blockchain to become a proof of stake blockchain. Okay, so I think firstly we need a quick recap of what proof of stake is.
Yeah.
For anyone who missed that episode or just
and
wasn't paying
potentially
attention.
Me who may have forgotten.
And potentially who I saw the information go in one ear and just dribble out the other. Okay. So As we know, a proof-of-work blockchain has miners, and they expend energy in the form of computing power in order to win the chance to create a block and add it to the blockchain. And of course, the winning miner in that situation gets the block reward as remuneration for their efforts. And I should point out as well that proof-of-work miners, they also get paid transaction fees as well. That's an added incentive for doing the work that they do. But the block reward is kind of the big headline grabber. Now, we've looked at this in detail before, but suffice to say that a proof-of-work chain is very secure because you would need to expend an insane amount of energy to try and corrupt it, certainly in Bitcoin's case. And probably that energy would probably cost more than you'd actually gain financially from corrupting the network, assuming that the network didn't, you know, that Bitcoin itself didn't go to zero because everyone realized it had been corrupted. But anyway, so Bitcoin's blockchain is also super decentralized because there are so many miners on the network and because there are so many nodes as well who aren't miners, but do, you know, they do run the Bitcoin software. So they are participating on the network. Now, there are disadvantages, though, because obviously proof of work blockchain is extremely expensive. It chews up a lot of energy and it is now very expensive to become a Bitcoin miner, because your electricity bill is insane and you need lots of expensive equipment to do it. Proof of work, because of this energy use, because of the way it's built, it's also kind of heavy and slow. It can't process many transactions per second. Bitcoin, yeah, is about 7 or 8 transactions per second, which is nothing really. Proof of stake, however, works differently. On a proof of stake chain, miners are instead known as validators, as I said earlier, and instead of expending computing power to try and get chosen to add the next block to the chain, validators, yeah, they stake the blockchain's native coin. They put their money down. And again, remember, I think the best way to think of this is through the lottery analogy. So with proof of work, the more energy you expend, the more lottery tickets you get, the more chances you have to win. Proof of stake works similarly. In its case, the more the validators stake, the higher their chances of getting chosen. It's like, you know, that's putting more money down to buy more lottery tickets again. So proof of stake, therefore, doesn't need lots of computers running, you know, hashing all the time. The winner of the lottery is instead chosen at random. And this means, as you can probably guess, this drastically lowers the amount of energy that a proof-of-stake chain consumes. I mean, it's 99.9% less. It's a negligible amount of energy, really, in the grand scheme of things, to run a proof-of-stake blockchain.
But people with more moolah or more...
Yeah, and
coin
this,
or whatever.
Yeah, this is the big. This
get
is
rewarded
the big,
more frequently.
Yeah, exactly. This is the problem that, you know, proof of work lovers, Bitcoiners will raise about proof of stake, and it's a very valid point. You know, okay, what happens if someone? It gives a lot of power to those
the
with
whales.
Money. Yeah, to the whales. Proof of stake. It is much faster, a higher TPS score, more transactions per second. Because it's not relying on all this heavy computing power to be done. And it has, as a result, become by far the most popular blockchain consensus model. And this is especially in terms, going back to this energy usage again, this is especially as ESG, environmental, social and governance concerns, have come to shape investor behavior, especially big investors. And nowadays, if you're a big institution wanting to invest, you have to have an eye on ESG. And obviously, a lot of people say, well, because Bitcoin uses so much electricity, it's therefore bad for the planet. And that ignores the fact that a lot of that electricity comes from renewable sources. It ignores the fact that Bitcoin mining has become a lot more energy efficient. But I'm not going to fall down that rabbit hole because I think I've spoken about this before. Now, as you say, Mike, the concerns are that proof of stake is not as decentralized or as secure as proof of work, because the higher stake, higher chance model means that those who are able to stake more are basically able to get selected to validate a block and claim the reward more. So, and for instance, in order to become a validator on Ethereum, you need to stake 32 ETH.
Mm.
I mean, that is hundreds of thousands of dollars, which is not, you know, not money that most people have. On some other proof of stake chains, the barrier to entry is even higher. You know, that the the minimum stake to become a validator can be hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of the particular coin. And also, in some cases, you need pretty up-to-date hardware as well. You need pretty expensive hardware. So again, this raises the concerns around centralization. How can you call something decentralized if only a handful of people
who can afford it can do it?
Yeah. And of course, staking can be very profitable because you get a cut of you stand a chance to win these block rewards, and you also get network fees as well. Now, there are ways that the man or woman in the street can participate in a proof of stake blockchain. You can actually delegate. So you can put money into a staking pool, which means you basically lend your ETH, for instance, to someone else, and they will in order that they can run a validator themselves. So let's say there's a group of us, none of us have the 32 ETH required to become a validator, but if we pooled all that together, then we'd have enough to run a validator node, and then we could obviously split up any money that we earn from that. A bit like a lottery syndicate, I guess. You know, everyone clubs together, they buy loads of tickets, and they split any winnings. And so it is possible for non-whales to stake as well. But there are still a lot of concerns around centralization with proof of stake. But as I said, that hasn't stopped it becoming much really, really popular for a whole load of reasons, not least environmental concerns, but also speed as well. And it was these concerns around speed and scalability that got Vitalik interested in proof of stake. And since kind of 2017, 2018, he's been working to move Ethereum onto a proof of stake model. Now, as you can imagine, for a project that has gotten as big as Ethereum with so much going on, that is not easy. And this is why the switch over to proof of stake has been going on for years now. They've been working on this, as I say, since kind of 2017, 18. So what's that, over 4 years now. But it's a necessary one, though. Ethereum is so dominant, so many projects are building on it, that it needs to be able to scale. It can't go on the way it is. And this slowness has made it unusable at times.
When the fees get too high.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I wanted to mention at this point, actually. Gas fees. Because if you'll remember, in order to transact on the Ethereum network, let's say I want to send some ETH to you, I have to pay a fee for the miners on the network to process that transaction. That's kind of a reward for their computing power, and that's a part of the reason, part of the way that miners on a proof of work network, that's part of how they earn their crust, if you like. Now, the problem is that when there are so many people trying to transact, when there are so many transactions queuing up when so many people are trying to buy and sell and breed digital cats, there's this huge backlog of transactions waiting to go through. And what happens is that some people are willing to pay more gas to the miners to have their transaction prioritized.
It's kind of surge charge.
Yeah. And what this means is that the gas price gets progressively bid up. And so in order to get your transaction processed, you at times have to pay an absolutely exorbitant fee. And gas prices on Ethereum have become insane. Not all the time. It is still possible to transact relatively cheaply on Ethereum. But at times of high demand, forget it. And a recent example, let's go back to NFTs again. You mentioned the Bored Ape Yacht Club. So recently, the Bored Ape Yacht Club held a sale of virtual land for its metaverse project, which is called Otherside. And demand for these virtual land NFTs, which is how the virtual land was sold, was just insane. And I saw there was actually an article here in The Guardian, in the mainstream press, that reported that one user had bought two NFTs for a total of £9,000. I mean, that's, what's that, $11,000 or something? That's what the NFTs had cost them. The gas in order to execute these transactions was £11,000.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that silence says it all. It's insane. And but I mean, at a time like this, when you might say, well, why on earth would anyone do this? Well, at a time like this, there's a limited number of these NFTs being sold. There's a lot of demand for them. And most people would look at that and go, forget it. You know, I don't want it that badly. But other people would be like, yeah, I want one of these NFTs. I think it's the same with,
you know, you see these Supreme shop drops and there is a fire extinguisher with Supreme written on it.
Mm.
And it's like £5,000 and you're like, what?
Yeah.
But someone buys it and it's instantly worth £50,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
The second market or whatever it's called is just crazy for these things. And there's people out there willing to pay it. It's kind of like art, I suppose, in the same way that, you know.
Yeah.
I've got the actual Mona Lisa or I've got a print.
Yeah. One is going to be worth
it. It's mental, more. But us, we've created this mentality.
Yeah. I mean, it's human behavior, isn't it? When there's a frenzy, when there's a feeding frenzy, people are willing to pay these insane gas costs. These gas costs get bid up to, just eye-watering degree. And so this is a bad look for Ethereum. No one really wants this situation to continue. And the story of the last few years
apart from the miners,
who are doing doing pretty well out of it. So the last few years, Ethereum has been largely about moving over to proof of stake and Ethereum 2.0, which we're not allowed to call it. Now, the way that Ethereum is eventually going to solve this problem, if you like, is...
They should call it Re-Ethereum.
Re-Ethereum. I like it. Vitalik, if you're listening, there you are.
Mm.
Yeah, okay. I'm sure he's scribbling frantically on a pad. This Ethereum 2.0 is going to employ a technique which is known as sharding. Okay, now this is actually this is something that existed before blockchain. But
it's the burning of.
No, this isn't burning. This is slightly different. So this basically will see a group in Ethereum's case of 64 additional blockchains known as shard chains run in parallel to the main Ethereum chain. Okay, so it's basically like, imagine, you've got your blockchain, which is very slow because it's very congested. So it's basically kind of siphoning off all this activity onto these separate chains. It's like, I guess, if you're building a road, a one lane road and it gets congested, you just build more lanes so as more cars can travel down it. That's basically what sharding is, adding extra blockchains. Now, the main Ethereum proof of stake chain, which has been launched, is going to be the Beacon chain. So this is going to be, if you like, at the heart of Ethereum. But these shard chains will take a lot of the pressure off of the Beacon chain, but they will occasionally submit an updated report of their status to the Beacon chain, so as the whole network can be updated. Now, the Beacon chain itself actually shipped on the 1st of December 2020, and this introduced proof of stake to Ethereum and marked the first stage of the transition. So this transition is very much underway. The next stage is the merge, and this is where the current Ethereum mainnet will merge with the Beacon chain, and Ethereum at that point will cease altogether to be a proof of work network. Okay, so the merge is the next big thing on the horizon as we speak. Now, it was originally scheduled, it's been kind of put back a lot. It was scheduled for early 2022, but has since been pushed back to Q3 or Q4 now. So kind of towards in the second half of the year. And this has become a bit of a running joke in the crypto community about how long the switch to, the merge is taking. And the final stage, the actual introduction of shard chains, that is scheduled for 2023, assuming the merge happens this year. And that should mark the end of Ethereum's transition. But we are still waiting. Now,
What about those holding the original Ethereum?
Well, there isn't going to be. I mean, that's a good point.
No, the one from where there was that breach.
Oh, Ethereum Classic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not many people are talking about Ethereum Classic.
Yet.
It's going to be, yeah, I don't think Ethereum Classic.
It's like having a BlackBerry.
Yeah. So, well, you still got ETH Classic, eh? Good on you. Now, this is from the Ethereum website. I was trying to find a way to express why we can't say Ethereum 2.0 anymore, so I'll just say what the website says. So, quote, after merging ETH1 and ETH2 into a single chain, there will no longer be two distinct Ethereum networks. There will only be one Ethereum. So to limit confusion, the community has updated these terms. ETH1 is now the execution layer. ETH2 is now the consensus layer.
Consensus.
Which handles proof of stake consensus. Mm. Okay. And there were additional, there were a few kind of additional points around why we couldn't say ETH2. One of it pertained to scammers, because a lot of scammers were sort of getting in touch with people saying, hey, you know, Ethereum's transitioning. Well, you can swap your ETH1 for ETH2 here. Just send it to this address and bye-bye money.
Oh, funny.
Not if you've been scammed. Yeah. So, were you yawning there?
Yeah.
Okay. That's good to know. So Ethereum has undergone several network upgrades in order to pave the way for proof of stake. The most important one recently was the London upgrade. That was back in August 2021. London upgrade implemented a number of Ethereum improvement proposals, or EIPs.
You done with EIP?
Yeah. That's pretty self-explanatory, isn't it? An Ethereum improvement proposal. It's like, I have an idea of how to improve Ethereum. The most significant of these in the London upgrade was EIP 1559, and this made changes to Ethereum's gas fee structure. And one of the most important aspects of this change was that a portion of gas fees would from that point on
be burned,
yeah, and removed from circulation altogether.
And because there's no total number, is there? There's no.
That's right.
Game.
Yeah, Ethereum doesn't have ETH doesn't have a fixed supply unlike Bitcoin. Bitcoin. Mm. Obviously, 21 million BTC will be mined, and that's it. Ethereum has no fixed supply. And this had a lot of people concerned, well, you know, how is an asset that its supply is constantly increasing, how is that going to hold its value? And, I mean, you know, ETH is so useful for using the Ethereum network that, you know, it's always going to have, I think, the demand, even if there is a large supply. But the fact that so much of it is now being burned, so many of these gas fees are being burned, has raised the possibility that with enough network activity, ETH could become deflationary. Okay, so and that has you know, pretty serious implications, potential implications for the price of ETH as well. You know, a lot of people saying, well, you know, if this asset becomes deflationary and demand stays the same, if supply decreases and demand remains the same or
can't
increases,
can't they just put a little proposition to go, okay, cool, we'll burn less?
I suppose they could, but I don't think...
If it's burning too much.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that they want it to become deflationary.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes it more valuable. There is always going to be new ETH being created.
But it's that ratio that needs to be tweaked.
And, yeah, there's as we speak, there is a lot of anticipation around the merge and proof of stake. Now, a lot of people think that as soon as the merge happens, gas fees are going to go down, you know, to very little and everything will be fine. It's not that simple. This is such a big transition. This is such a big project that it's going to take a while. And, you know, not until we've got shard chains, really, and even probably a bit beyond the introduction of sharding. It's going to be a while before Ethereum, you know, gas is going to cost, you know, a few cents, like it does on some other proof of stake chains. But we're getting there. Let's take another break, shall we?
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults.
you know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
We're back for part 3 of this episode of Ethereum. This is it for Ethereum.
Not really, but
for the podcast. Yeah, I think we've covered this ad nauseum. Okay, so I just want to quickly talk about something that's come up again in response to these scaling issues that Ethereum has and the kind of slow rollout of this proof of stake that's attracted a lot of criticism. So, as I say, at times of high demand, as we know, the network is pretty much unusable unless you're prepared to pay insane gas fees. But recently, we've seen the emergence of some projects that make using Ethereum easier, and these are known as Layer 2s. Layer 2 scaling solutions, to give them their full title. Obviously, Ethereum being a Layer 1. Layer 2s, and some examples here, Polygon, Optimism, Arbitrum, are all examples of Layer 2 projects. They're built on top of Ethereum, but they use their own chains to compute transactions off the main Ethereum chain. And they reference the main Ethereum chain for security purposes, but take the transactional strain off of it. And this obviously allows for faster and cheaper transactions than would be possible on the main chain. And these have become a very useful stopgap whilst we wait for shard chains and proof of stake in general. And these layer twos, like shard chains, they can periodically submit summaries of their data to the main chain to keep the whole network updated. But they've been useful to take some of the strain off the main Ethereum network. That said, it's still often slow and expensive to use. You know, these layer twos have helped, but they haven't solved the problem. And again, as we've seen, these kind of rival layer ones have taken advantage of this situation to make some inroads into Ethereum's market share. But none of them have so far come close to mounting a serious challenge to Ethereum's dominance. And I'm going to go as far as to say that if the move to proof of stake is completed relatively soon and without any disasters happening along the way, then for me it's kind of hard to see how Ethereum could be toppled. It's not impossible. I mean, it could still happen, but Ethereum is so dominant, you know. It does surprise me in a way, even though it can become so unusable, even though the Ethereum experience can be pretty miserable sometimes if you're trying to pile into some hot new NFT project or something like that. Despite all this, people are still building on it. It has so much use, and I struggle to see how another project is going to take that away. Certainly in the short term, it's going to be a very long term thing to try and chip away at Ethereum's lead. I mean, I think the future, like anyone who imagines that the future of crypto is going to be, you know, sort of one chain to rule them all and thing like that, is wrong. I think there are going to be lots of different blockchains. There are lots of other, you know, cryptocurrency blockchains that do different things. It's not all about Bitcoin and then a whole load of layer twos. You know, there are lots of cryptos that do different things. But it's going to be interesting to see how this kind of layer one landscape shapes up, and you know whether some layer ones will kind of specialize in, you know, in kind of some aspects. You know, maybe one or two blockchains will emerge as kind of the blockchains for NFTs or something like that. Maybe one particular blockchain or a small handful of them will be where most of, you know, decentralized finance kind of eventually finds itself. But it's so difficult to predict how this might pan out, and so the easiest thing for the moment is to say, well, it's still very much, the ball is still very much in Ethereum's court, and obviously it has this kind of network effects, you know, this first mover advantage. It's built up so much activity that it's going to be very difficult for another project to overtake that. And these rival projects, and I'm going to use the examples of Cardano and Polkadot here, they have kind of gone about it a different way, you know, rather than Ethereum kind of launched, it's like, this is what we can do, and they've been trying to basically correct it as they go along ever since. These other projects are sort of starting, you know, having learned the lessons of what has happened before on Ethereum, they're building these supposedly much more resilient networks that should theoretically be able to scale to handle Ethereum's volume. Most of these are still very much in development.
Infancy, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Polkadot is an interesting one. Polkadot uses something, its main chain is called the Relay chain. And then it has what are called parachains, which are these kind of separate blockchains that work in a kind of similar way to shards. And the Polkadot network is in the middle of kind of rolling these parachains out, and various projects. Each parachain is reserved for one particular project, and at the moment it's conducting what are called parachain slot auctions in order for, you know, whichever projects are building on Polkadot, they're basically bidding to get a parachain slot. And that's how that's going to work. But so the Polkadot network is growing. Cardano is doing it slightly differently. Cardano is basically a peer-reviewed project. So rather than kind of put the network out there and see what happens, they've been building it painstakingly for years now. Every stage is being peer-reviewed. You know, it's going out to all these various developers and scientists and people like that to look over, with the hope that, you know, when it's up and fully functioning, they will have spotted every potential problem, and it'll, you know, run like Ethereum, like we'd all like Ethereum to run. But obviously this is a slow process. Smart contracts have only been enabled on Cardano for a few months. They're still kind of rolling out dApps. There are lots of projects building on it, but they're still, you know, it's still very much in development. So that is the kind of landscape at the moment. Ethereum is the daddy in that particular niche of cryptocurrency. There are lots of projects lining up to try and take its crown, to try and take it down. But Ethereum, this change to proof of stake, this change to Ethereum 2 that we're not allowed to call it, is a huge factor in the whole crypto space at the moment. Really, everyone is kind of waiting on this to happen. And yeah, I want to finish up by saying, you know, Ethereum is capturing the public imagination more and more. You know, it's not just all the stuff that's happening on it. It's not just the fact that Vitalik is such a prominent figure in crypto and beyond, I think, as well. He was on the cover of Time magazine recently. You know, he really is becoming a kind of global figure. And you'll remember that a few times during these Ethereum episodes, I've referenced a couple of books. One was The Cryptopians by Laura Shin, and the other one was The Infinite Machine by Camilla Russo. The Infinite Machine was actually the first. Both of them are about the early days of Ethereum. Well, The Infinite Machine has just been optioned. The film rights have just been bought by Ridley Scott's company.
Talk about a blockbuster.
Oh, God. On that note, let's end it.
Because there's a blockchain.
Yeah, that's quite enough.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks for listening.
See you soon. Thank you so much for listening to the Coin Bureau podcast. If you'd like to learn more about cryptocurrency, you can visit our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Coin Bureau. You can also go to coinbureau.com for loads more information about all things crypto. You can follow me on Twitter at Coin Bureau, all one word. And I'm also active on TikTok and Instagram as well.
First of all, it's not thank you for listening. You're welcome for great content. Yeah? Like, this is free. And they're learning about a fairly great topic in a non-boring way. If you'd like to visit me and hear more about me, go to Moochabout, MOOCHABOUT, or else.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. The Coin Bureau podcast is a production of iHeartRadio.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.